This is East End Inc. As part of its celebration of the bicentennial of Herman Melville's birth, the nonprofit Canio's Cultural Cafe is presenting a series of events, lectures, film screenings, and an upcoming community read-in of Melville's classic novel, Moby Dick, at various Sag Harbor locations on June the 7th through the 9th. More about that later. Earlier this month, Mary Kay Edwards, Melville's scholar and sailor, spoke about her sailing adventures aboard the Charles W. Morgan, an 1841 whale ship, and what she learned about Herman Melville along the way. Mary Kay Edwards was introduced by Canio's Catherine Soker.
Over the past several years, Marianne and I have gone up to New Bedford's Whaling Museum for their marathon, which is truly a delight. And one of the wonderful things that happens there is you meet great people. And one of the great persons that we met was Mary Kay Edwards Burkow, who's here with us tonight. Mary Kay is a Melville scholar and a sailor. He's taught literature of the sea for the William Mystic and Maritime Studies program at the University of Connecticut. She serves as editor for Leviathan, a journal of Melville studies, and is the author of Melville's Sources and Cannibal Old Me, Spoken Sources in Melville's Early Work. She's presently working on a book entitled Sailor Talk, Labor, Utterance, and Meaning in the Works of Melville, Conrad, and London. She spends her summers high aloft on Mystic Seaport Museum's square rigged ships. She's a Coast Guard licensed captain and has 58,000 miles at sea under her belt or under her feet. I'm not sure exactly what the right expression is. Please give a very warm Sag Harbor welcome to me.
I'm just going to give you a little background on Melville's life first and how it tied to his books, and then I'll talk directly about what happened when we sailed on the Charles W. Morgan, the only wooden whaling ship left in the world, and how that changed our view of Melville. So Melville was born on August 1st, 1819. So he sailed from New York to Liverpool and back to New York aboard a packet ship named the St. Lawrence at 1849 at the age of 19, and from that came his fourth book, Redburn, which was published in 1849. He left from New Bedford on January 3rd, 1841. He actually sailed from Fairhaven, which is right across from New Bedford. And that, of course, was the beginning of his time on the Acushnet. As they have always said, the Acushnet was normal in every way. It sailed out of the largest of all whaling ports. There was nothing unusual about it, except that it carried an immortal pin, which was Melville. So he sailed on the Acushnet for 18 months, and from that came his book, of course, Moby Dick, published in 1851, which was his sixth book. During that time, he visited the Galapagos, and he was in there in November of 1841 and January of 1842, and from that came a series of 10 sketches that he published in 1854, which were called the Incantatas, which are set in the Galapagos. And then he deserted from the Acushnet when he got to Nukahiva in the Marquesas. And the fact that he deserted was totally normal. Men deserted whale ships all the time. The labor force aboard whale ships was incredibly fluid. I don't think there's ever been one whaling voyage that returned at the end with the exact same men that left aboard. So people left, and then they would desert, and then they would get homesick, and they would join another ship, and then they'd leave, and then they'd join another ship. So there was kind of this back and forth all the time. It used to be thought that Melville's captain was especially brutal, and that's why he left, but there's been a lot of study of him done, and there's nothing, and Melville was just acting like all the other whalemen when he ran away. But he was in Nukahiva. He was ashore from July 9th to August 9th, 1842, and from that came his first book, which is called Typee, published in 1846. And then after a while, he got homesick like all these other sailors had done, and so he joined another whale ship on August 9th, 1842, which was named the Lucy Ann, and it was very poorly captained. The captain was sick, the first mate was a drunkard. There was no second mate. The third mate was called acting third mate, which is one way to disempower an officer, is just to call him acting. He was illiterate, so he wasn't able to keep the logbook. So it was just incredibly poorly officered. So the men mutinied, including Melville, and he was put in a Tahitian jail and then incarcerated, and then he escaped, basically by walking away one night, and went to the next island and joined a third whale ship. So all those adventures end up in his second book, Omu. And it sounds like too much to have happened. You know, like, could all that be real? But we actually have documentation for every element of that. He joined his third whale ship, which was named the Charles and Henry. That was the first time he had a lot of respect for the captain. So the captain of the Charles B. Henry, John B. Coleman Jr., it was a vessel from Nantucket, so a Nantucket captain. And if I'm hoping you all know Moby Dick really well, but if you remember the Nantucket chapter, Nantucket looks really good in Moby Dick. Melville actually had not visited Nantucket until after Moby Dick was published, but that positive portrayal of the island is partly because of his interacting with John B. Coleman. And he served as a harpooner, or what was called a boat steer, aboard the Charles and Henry. And from that time, that short time, became the beginning of his third book, which is called Marty, published in 1849. And so he was discharged in Lahaina, Maui, because he had only signed up for the length of the passage, not the length of the voyage. And he tried to make his way. He made his way from Lahaina to Honolulu. He was trying to make his living ashore. He set up pins in a bowling alley, one of the great bits of trivia. The people who set up pins, you know, now they're done by those machines that go pop, and they do it. But before that, they had children do it, or sailors, because sailors were so nimble, they could crawl around the backs of the bowling alleys. And but then he finally just got really, really homesick. And so he joined the naval frigate United States. The United States no longer exists, but she was built at the same time as the Constitution. So when you walk around the Constitution up in Boston, it's almost exactly the same as Melville's own, the ship that Melville sailed on, the United States. And from that came his fifth book, White Jacket, which was published in 1850. He headed home, and while he was aboard the United States, he was aboard for 14 months, and he witnessed 163 floggings. And from that, so he was never flogged. And actually, the United States wasn't even considered a blood ship. That was just sort of normal, the amount of flogging. And from that came an absolute hatred of flogging. So that really comes out strongly in his fifth book, White Jacket, published in 1850, the same year that flogging was abolished in the United States Navy. Also, that marring of the human body was a hatred that he developed partly from that. And if you think about it, it comes up again and again in his books. He's appalled in his first book, Typee, at the idea of being tattooed. The idea of the holy body being sort of marked that way really. And partly what's going on with Ahab and Moby Dick is that he's been disfigured. His body has been, you know, the beauty and holiness of his body has been marred by the loss of his leg. And that ties into his same feelings about flogging. So he returns to Boston in October of 1844. And his family had been quite wealthy. His father was an importer of French goods, gone bankrupt when he was 10 and died when he was 12. And so his mother was left with 8 children and no way of making a living. She'd never worked, but she'd never even had servants. So the family was sort of thrust into poverty. And that's how come he ended up going as an ordinary sailor. Somebody from his class would normally have sailed as an officer, but he started out just as an ordinary sailor because of this background. And he comes home and his family's still in terrible financial traits. So that led to his writing career. He was an amazing storyteller. We have a lot of evidence of that from journals and letters written by other people. This story may be apocryphal, but it said that his family said, "Herman, you should write those stories down." And then he starts writing. And that led to his writing career. So the last time he sailed was, around Cape Horn on the clipper ship Meteor under the command of his younger brother, Thomas Melville, who was the
Sailor Snug Harbor.
Staten Island.
Yeah. And that that was his younger brother, and he sailed under him, just sailed on the vessel, and that was his last time at sea. And the other connection he has to vessels was that his cousin, Gert Gansevoort, was part of a drumhead court aboard the brig Summers that condemned and hung three men. It's often called the only mutiny in the United States Navy, including Philip Spencer, the son of the Secretary of War. Like, can you imagine, like, hanging the son of the Secretary of War? So the captain, Alexander Slidell Mackenzie, was court-martialed and exonerated, but the public remained skeptical about the need to have hung those three men. And that sort of festered in Melville's kind of life and his psyche, and it comes out in Billy Budd, which wasn't published until after he died, long after he died. It wasn't published for the first time until 1924. It was left in manuscript when Melville died. So those are his sea works and just the dates. But you can see how he took his time at sea and sort of transformed it into all those fictional pieces. But they are not those are pieces of fiction. They're not autobiography. So he just takes these experiences he had and, like I said, just kind of changes them, transforms them, imbues them with all kinds of questions, and that's becomes his works. So Melville served on three whale ships, working his way up from the position of green hand aboard the Acushnet through able seaman on the Lusiane to boat steerer, which was the old-fashioned term for harpooner, on the Charles and Henry. Melville would later claim to his British publisher, Richard Bentley, that he had had, quote, a personal experience of 2 years and more as a harpooner, but in fact, his time on the Charles and Henry only lasted 6 months. So that he was always a little exaggerated in his claims. In Moby Dick, Ishmael signs on board the Pequod as a green hand. Like Melville himself, Ishmael had sailed on a merchant vessel, but never before on a whale ship. Ishmael is assigned to Starbuck's whaleboat crew and serves as bow oarsman, an important position because the bow oarsman is the backup, in 19th century terms, the preventer to the boat steerer or harpooner. Ishmael writes in chapter 72, The Monkey Rope, that he is Queequeg's, quote, bowsman, that is the person who pulled the bow oar in his boat, the second one from forward. So, next slide, please. The Pequod in Moby Dick leaves New Bedford in the dead of winter. They left on January 3rd, 1841. Just think about that. I think about that all the time. I go to New Bedford every year for the Moby Dick Marathon, and we're up there on January 3rd, and I can't even conceive of getting onto a vessel where you have to climb aloft in order to set the sails and heading out to sea. I mean, it's going to get warmer, but it's going to take a little while. But they left in Moby Dick. They leave on Christmas Day. In real life, he left on January 3rd. But they had that timing was critical to ensure that the vessel reached the southernmost tip of South America or Cape Horn during the Southern Hemisphere summer. Intriguingly, despite his own experience with Cape Horn, including his understanding of why a midwinter departure was necessary, and despite the fact that he himself never sailed around the southern tip of Africa, it is to the Cape of Good Hope that Melville takes the Pequod in chapter 51, The Spirit Spout of Moby Dick. So I have no idea why he has them go around the Cape of Good Hope. He never sailed there, but he does in the book. So this is the quote. At last, when turning to the eastward, the Cape winds began howling around us, and we rose and fell upon the long, troubled seas that are there. Cape of Good Hope, do they call you? Rather, Cape Tormentoso. Melville's howling winds and troubled seas better describe the Cape Horn, which is at 55.98 degrees south, 21 degrees farther south than Cape of Good Hope, 34.36 degrees south. If you've ever wondered why sea narratives always have Cape Horn, why Cape Horn is the terrifying place to go, you can just look and see how much farther south it is. So the Pequod is in many ways a fantastical ship, with its belaying pins made of sperm whale teeth and its tiller made from the lower jaw of a sperm whale. It has become, like its captain, quote, a cannibal of a craft, tricking herself forth in the chaste bones of her enemies. So, you know, a cannibal is something that eats its own species, devours its own species. And Melville has made the Pequod into part whale. You know, it's got sperm whale teeth. It's got the lower jaw of a sperm whale. And he calls it a cannibal craft because it is, you know, eating whales. It's going after whales. And, of course, the other thing that's part whale in Moby Dick is, Ahab himself. Yeah. And Ahab constantly talks about himself as a cannibal. He calls himself Cannibal Old Me. And he just reflects on cannibalism all the time.
This is East End Inc. We're listening to Melville scholar and ship captain, Mary K. Edwards. She spoke this month at Sag Harbor's Canyons Books as part of a celebration of the bicentennial of Herman Melville's birth.
There's also a lot of discrepancies within Melville's text concerning the Pequod. The whale ship first has a tiller, but later a wheel. The whalemen sleep mostly in hammocks, but occasionally in bunks. Melville notes that there are 30 men on board, but if you are a true Melville nerd like myself, you will have counted every person individually in the book. And there are actually 45 different characters. Even if you say, well, maybe Archie could be first Nantucket sailor. Even when you do that, there's still 45 people. But he says there's 30 people. Yet Melville has created a grim, trophy-studded vessel that haunts the reader's mind. So I just acknowledge that there's mistakes. I just think that he could have, he needed post-its, like 30 men, you know, bunks. And one of my favorite things, I forgot to mention, is that the which leg is missing changes in the book. So sometimes it's a, people are always asking me, they always say, I want to be Ahab for Halloween. Which leg should I be? Ah, whichever one you want. Because sometimes it's left, sometimes it's right, sometimes it's above the knee, and sometimes it's below the knee. So underneath the haunting quality of the Pequod lies an actual, verifiable, and detailed description of whaling. Melville's understanding of whaling was not only intellectual, aesthetic and moral, but also kinesthetic. It was that kinesthetic quality that we hoped to capture in the summer of 2014 when we took the whale ship Charles W. Morgan to sea and what was known as the 38th voyage. So she made 37 whaling voyages, so we called our voyage in 2014 the 38th. So launched in 1841, the Morgan, the only remaining wooden whale ship in the world, spent the summer of 2014 sailing throughout New England. She had completed the last of her 37 voyages in 1921, and this was the next time she went to sea. So the Morgan is no replica. She is a real whale ship built only 7 miles from and 7 months after the Acushnet, the one Melville sailed on. When the Morgan left Mystic, Connecticut on May 17th, 2014, there was no one alive who had ever sailed a whale ship. What would taking the vessel to sea and lowering whaleboats from her davits while underway teach us about Melville's magnificent work? Most surprisingly, we learned that the Morgan was quick, swift, and nimble. Whale ships are tubby. Look at her. Yeah. They're meant to carry a large number of oil casks in their hold, and we had long thought that the Morgan would be very slow, estimating that she would average between 3 and 5 knots, a little better than 3 to 5 miles per hour. But no one had told the Morgan that. I feel like she was like, I am so sick of hearing this. This is not true. And the her very, very first sea trial, the very first day she was out under sail, she hit 7.5 knots, and she kept going faster and faster. She went over 9 knots. The captain loved it when she went that fast, but then he actually, you know, realized that she was, in fact, the only whale ship left in the world. So he took the sails down and kind of slowed her down. The other thing we learned was how much work is involved in sailing a whale ship. Melville scholars John Bryan and Hester Blum sailed aboard the Morgan, and they each wrote about the amount of labor involved. In an essay entitled Work, Bryant writes, "What I learned is that a ship is a place of work. I had known this intellectually, had read about it a good deal, and had written about it from the perspective of those voyage books and my imagination, but now I could see it happening." Bryan ends his essay, "Work, it is said, is noble, but I don't know what noble means. Work at sea is hard, focused, intense, perilous, immediate." After experiencing the speed and nimbleness of the Morgan and the seamanship required to sail her, I would argue that Melville transforms not only the whale, but also the whaleman in Moby Dick. Peleg tells Ishmael when he applies to sail on the Pequod, "Merchant service be damned. Talk not that lingo to me. Dost see that leg? I'll take that leg away from thy stern if ever thou talkest of the merchant service to me again. Merchant service, indeed. In this moment, sailing as a whaleman is elevated above sailing as a merchant sailor. The skill of the sailors themselves is seen in passages such as the following, which are easily skipped over or lost in the driving excitement of the hunt for the white whale. At the beginning of chapter 133, the chase, first day, Ahab cries to Dagoo, "Call all hands!" Thundering with the butts of three clubbed handspikes on the forecastle deck, Dagoo roused the sleepers with such judgment claps that they seemed to exhale from the scuttle, so instantaneously did they appear with their clothes in their hands. "What do you see?" cried Ahab, flattening his face to the sky. "Nothing, nothing, sir," was the sound hailing down in reply. "T'gallant sails, stunsails, alow and aloft, and on both sides." The next paragraph begins simply, "All sails being set." The alacrity with which the sailors come on deck and the speed with which they set the t'gallant sails, the second highest sails on the mast, and then put up stunsails, perhaps the most complicated of all sails to set, are not the hallmarks of ineptitude. The speed and agility of the whale ship itself and the amount of seafaring labor required of the crew has caused me to sharply question the long-held perception of whalemen as poor sailors. The supposed lubberliness of whalemen pervades 19th century literature, sea literature. Whenever whenever whalemen are mentioned, they are just denigrated as bad sailors. Richard Henry Dana writes in 2 years before the mast, 1840, Tuesday, November 10th, "As soon as her anchor was down, we went aboard and found her to be the whale ship Wilmington and Liverpool Packet of New Bedford, last from the offshore ground with 1,900 barrels of oil. A spatter, we knew her as soon as we saw her by her crates and cranes and boats and by her stump to gallant masts and a certain slovenly look to the sails, rigging, spars, and hull. And when we got on board, we found everything so to correspond, spouter fashion. She had a false deck, which was rough and oily and cut up in every direction by the chimes of oil casks. Her rigging was slack and turning white. No paint on the spars or blocks. Clumsy seizings and straps without covers and homeward bound splices in every direction. Her crew, too, was not in much better order. Her captain was a slab-sided, shamble-legged Quaker in a suit of brown with a broad-brimmed hat and sneaking about decks like a sheep with his head down, and the men looked more like fishermen and farmers," the ultimate insult, "than they did like sailors." Dana exhibits the typical merchant sailor's contempt for whalemen. The ship itself, the men, the captain, all are slovenly. The sailors don't even know how to do a proper splice or seizing. Such ineptitude is summed up in two ways. First, by the very existence of the term spouter fashion. And second, by calling the sailors farmers, landsmen, the ultimate insult. Moby Dick is far more than a story of whaling. In chapter 16, Peleg describes Ahab as a grand, ungodly, godlike man. And Moby Dick itself is a grand, ungodly, godlike book. A book of blasphemy is also full of humor, which is in turn sly, boisterous, poignant, and hilarious. Moby Dick asks all the eternal questions of life. What is truth? Who are we? Does immortality exist? But answers none of them. The importance of the work, however, lies in asking such eternal questions. Most of all, it is the soaring language of Moby Dick that endures. Melville writes at the end of chapter 96, The Triworks, "There is a wisdom that is woe, but there is a woe that is madness. And there is a Catskill eagle in some souls that can alike dive down into the blackest gorges and soar out of them and become invisible in the sunny spaces. And even if he forever flies within the gorge, that gorge is in the mountains, so that even in the lowest swoop, the mountain eagle is still higher than other birds upon the plain, even though they soar." Whaling and language are exquisitely combined in chapter 48, The First Lowering, when the whaleboat is separated from the Pequod and the whalemen are forced to spend the night on the open sea. Cutting the lashing of the waterproof match keg after many failures, Starbuck, the first mate, contrived to ignite the lamp and the lantern, then stretching it on a waif pole, handed it to Queequeg as the standard bearer of this forlorn hope. "There then," he said, "holding up that imbecile candle and the heart of the almighty forlornness. There then he sat, the sign and symbol of a man without faith, hopelessly holding up hope in the midst of despair." The intertwining of whaling and language became visceral for me during the Morgan's voyage when we lowered a whaleboat and pulled one of the oars as we rowed amongst a pod of humpback whales. Melville quotations swarmed through me. Chapter 48, The First Lowering. not the raw recruit marching from the bosom of his wife into the fever heat of his first battle, not the dead man's lost a host encountering the first unknown phantom in the other world. Neither of these can feel stranger and stronger emotions than that man does, who for the first time finds himself pulling into the charm-churned circle of the hunted sperm whale. Chapter 49, The Hyena, when Ishmael asks, "Will you tell me whether it is an unalterable law in this fishery, Mr. Flask, for an oarsman to break his own back, pulling himself back foremost into death's jaws?" Chapter 60, The Line, "Nor can any son of mortal woman for the first time seat himself amid those humpen intricacies, and while straining his utmost at the oar, bethink him that at any unknown instant the harpoon may be darted, and all these horrible contortions be put in play like ringed lightnings. He cannot be thus circumstanced without a shudder that makes the very marrow in his bones to quiver in him like a shaken jelly." Deeply, profoundly moving as Melville's words are, they nonetheless had remained visceral to us only as language. Until the summer of 2014, the full body shudder that they evoked arose from the power of the language itself, rather than for participation in the experience he described. That forever changed with the 30th voyage of the Charles W. Morgan. Moby Dick begins, "Call me Ishmael." In Genesis, the first book of the Bible, Ishmael is the son of Abraham and of Hagar, who is the servant of Abraham's wife, Sarah. When Sarah gives birth to Isaac, Ishmael and Hagar are exiled to the desert. The narrator of Moby Dick asks us to call him by a name that signifies outcast, wanderer. Moby Dick ends with an epilogue that begins with a quotation from the book of Job, "And I only am escaped alone to tell thee," and ends heartbreakingly with the word orphan. The last mm-hmm. word in Moby Dick is orphan. Mm-hmm.
This is East End, Inc. We heard Melville scholar and ship captain Mary Kay Edwards. She spoke this month at Sag Harbor's Canyons Books as part of a celebration of the bicentennial of Herman Melville's birth. More about the whale ship Charles W. Morgan is online at mysticseaport.org/voyage/ship. Some upcoming free literary events sponsored by Canio's Cultural Cafe, 290 Main Street, Sag Harbor, include on Thursday, May the 30th at 6:30 p.m., a screening of the classic 1957 film Moby Dick, starring Gregory Peck at the John Germain Library, 201 Main Street in Sag Harbor. And on Friday, June the 7th through Sunday, June the 9th, a marathon reading of Melville's Moby Dick at various Sag Harbor locations, including the Old Whalers Church, the Sag Harbor Whaling Museum, the Eastville Historical Society, the John Germain Library, and Canio's Books. Readers from the community will be joined by actors Harris Yulin and Alec Baldwin, along with a local chorus at the church. On Saturday, June the 15th at 5 p.m., poets Maria Tyrone and Marisa Frasca read from their new work. And on Saturday, June the 22nd, 5 p.m., author Mary Norris reads from her new book, Greek to Me, Adventures of the Comma Queen. More events are listed at canios.wordpress.com. East End Inc. programs are archived at eastendinc.blogspot.com. Podcasts are available at soundcloud.com. Search for East End Inc. Today's program was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Marianne Callandrill and Catherine Soka. This is Hazel Kahn.